You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Happy New Year and welcome to the first Red Center of 2009. I'm joined by a very suntanned, happy and generally healthy-looking Jason Wingrove.
Thanks, mate.
Did you have a good break?
I did. How did you?
Do you want to annoy our North Hemisphere listeners by commenting on how incredibly relaxed you're looking in shorts, T-shirt and
yep.
Sun hat?
Shorts, T-shirt, and it's still hot. It's glorious. Well, not maybe today, but summer's been back with a vengeance. So, yeah, 37 degrees centigrade.
Yes, although I'm possibly going over to London for a red shoot, and it was like minus six when I looked. So
yeah.
It's going to be a bit of a culture shock.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at a couple of scripts for Kiev. And
that would be as in so chicken?
Radioactive chicken Kiev. And it's, yes, I did the same thing. Immediately you start looking at the weather. It hadn't been above freezing all week. So, yeah, so we'll see how that one goes.
Well, we have a good show to kick off the new year for you. We're going to be looking at post-production stuff, as was the most requested item from our Twitter query. We put out asking, what would you guys like to hear about? You said you want to hear more about post-production, so we've got one of those coming up. Looking at digital vision, discussing their Chapter 11, and also speaking to somebody that's done three, or actually is now on his third feature film, Grading Red. And also, you have a Red Room for us.
Yeah, I'm talking to Dave Geddes, who is a Canadian DP, who shot the first TV series on The Red.
Cool. And as always, we're going to start by kicking off with the news.
And now, the Red Setter News.
Well, the first one is a pretty big one, and I think it's actually obviously indicative of a lot of things that are going on, but no NAB for Red this year.
So that's a WTF from me.
Yeah, well, it made my decision whether I was going to go or not very, very easy.
That would be a no.
That would be a no.
Much as I
love flashing lights and lots of geeky people staring at oscilloscopes.
Sorry, I had the wrong flashy things. I must admit, I already have my ticket and already booked it, as we have the hotel rooms, so yeah. I'm less enthusiastic about their decision than you are.
Well, you've probably got to find a few other things to do there, but if I was pretty close to actually booking my ticket just on points and going, so I'd be pretty annoyed. But obviously their decision, not necessarily a financial one, but according to Red, at least it's based on the fact that they've had a bit of a delay with a technical supplier, and that means that they wouldn't have had any working prototypes, which obviously they were planning on, so it wasn't going to be worth their while. So theoretically, they're going to have their own Red Day at some other stage.
Now, that would that be at the Red Ranch
in Vegas?
Because the thing is, right, there was this lovely little triangle of Autodesk, Red, and Adobe that was going to be like where I could hang out and confidently run into all my friends.
Sadly,
the tech triangle. Okay, so they're not going. Clearly. Notwithstanding, you know, the fact that Red generally are very honest when they say things, they've indicated this is probably unlikely to affect the schedules, but you've got to be thinking it's going to affect it to a certain extent.
They said it'll affect it a little bit, but not to any great deal. We don't really know. The schedules are pretty loose anyway, so, you know, how do we know?
Yeah, but if you're not even showing a working prototype in April, it's unlikely you're going to go into production by September. You can
but if they
six
were
that,
if that. They were planning to, then that they were, you know, if they were planning to show working prototypes, you know, essentially in 3 months' time.
That's what they were, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't. That shows some reasonable progress, I think.
Oh yeah, we know images are coming out, but still, it's. I'm just disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But not disappointing as in I'm disappointed in the company, just disappointed as I wanted to have something to play with.
Yeah, well, look, I think in a way it's similar to Apple's move that not going to do any Macworlds, because that was partly built around the fact that they don't want to have those sort of show dates dictated by a show, what gear they've going to have to get ready. They didn't want to have dictated by, you know,
I think that was also
a trade
affected
show.
By Steve Jobs' health and a bunch of other things.
Yeah.
But also, surely a consumer electronics device, you can learn a heck of a lot off the web, and then they have global stores worldwide. Red, it's not like I can say, well, I'm going to just go down the Red shop and look at what they've got. You know, I mean, it is a chance to howl and to...
Yeah.
And let's face it, last year at NAB and at IBC, we only saw prototype mock-ups of the old design. So yes. No one's actually physically seen a prototype mock-up of the new design, even in plastic fake molding stage.
But people, they could probably get 50,000 trillion orders judged on just, you know, renders on Red User or renders at red.com, basically. They, you know, the hype is so huge.
Are they 50,000 trillion?
50,000 trillion.
Yes, okay.
That's, they could basically...
Because this is a place to go for not hyping things.
Don't come to me for the
math. I understand what you're saying, and I respect that. But still, I think there's something about you need some physical interaction with customers, with prototypes to discuss how things are going to be milled because, you know.
Oh, that's how you nut out a lot of issues.
It's a physical thing.
Absolutely. No, look, I think they should, and so they should. So, I mean,
so this is the design of a laptop is pretty easy, right? Because it's like it goes on your lap, and your lap is... My lap. It's not very complicated, unfortunately. This is something that's going on your shoulder that's a handheld kind of multi-modular rig with fasteners and stuff. I want to see what the fasteners are like. I want to see how the connectors are going to work. I'm going to see what the weight distribution is. There's a lot of stuff there that isn't a problem for a PC Apple-type company saying, here's a laptop.
Yeah, I guess that this design, breaking the mold so much as it does, yes, you do want to you do want to know, and particularly when every little bit, it's not just one big camera with everything in it at once now. It's, you know, you're buying it modularly, so you want to, you know, you do want to know, get the idea of, if I add this bit and this bit and this bit and this bit, how heavy is it going to be? Is it going to be, you know, what can I get rid of, or what extra do I need?
It's, yeah, and doubly so when there are so many options. Because like, let's say you said to me, are you going to buy an Epic? Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Which one? Well, I think this one, but I haven't actually seen it yet. So, I mean, you could effectively, from take me as a, you know, generic me, not me as the individual, say, I want to buy a camera. I want to buy an Epic. I'm just not exactly sure until I see it which one. Because, let's face it, the red one looked smaller in all the photography. Everybody I know that first saw the body of the red one, it's a bit bigger than I expected.
Yeah, that maybe will be the same. It might go the other way for Scarlett and Epic. Everyone's going, oh, geez, small. You do want to be able to sort of feel and touch these things and see them in, or at least see photos of somebody hand-holding them or see them in, you know, rather than just a floating 3D render in space.
Yeah, and I guess what is the next opportunity? Is it IBC, which is where they've been before, or would they go to a, you know...
Just their own thing, I guess, when they're ready. Do essentially, as I say, the Apple thing, they're going to start doing, you know, holding it on their own campus and their own
time. I just don't feel like the Apple thing's a good comparison because you know, you don't need to go to Apple to check it out because, as I say, there's like a store, right?
Mm.
Like, and if they have a red day, like everyone's going to just fly just for the red day. I mean, you'd want to be getting a free camera if you're going to trek up around the planet for a...
Or the ability to order one.
Yes.
Get in, get to the beginning of the queue as you did.
We have the Red Ranch open day, first in, first served.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's exactly. That's what maybe that's what everyone was hoping for this time around. Everyone who was poised, ready to book their NAB tickets were maybe hoping for the bull rush to the stand to put your money down. But, so that won't be
happening. Adobe's still there. No Apple, no Avid, no Red.
It's a sign of the times.
Mm.
The internet, obviously not so much for Red. But
a non-original prediction here. 3 years, NAB's dead to us.
Sure, lots of things. Magazines, newspapers.
Where's my rocket pack? Okay, so let's shift gears and discuss gear.
Well, I've got a bit more news.
Oh, you have more news?
I have news. Oh, we have, for the first time, we have a hot list. We have a rap sheet. On Christmas Eve.
The police, this is police beat now.
Yes, a two-person production company going by the name of B&H Films in town to, where they were in Boston, to shoot a supposed T-Mobile shoot. Hired camera gear from red outfits from two separate camera rental houses. Picked up a whole crew off Craigslist. I'm not quite sure how you do that, but maybe in America you can get whole crews off Craigslist. I don't know what kind of crew they are, but there you go. Saturday, December 24th was meant to be the scheduled shoot day. All the crew turn up. No B&H Films, no Red cameras. So Red number 1746 and Red 4452.
Are in the wild.
That's interesting, that serial number. Not sure. 4452, sets of standards, cooked 10 to 1s, red bricks, you name it. So I will go through it quickly just because this may sort of ping someone's... prick up someone's ears. So first of all, from Boston Camera, Red 1746, a Cook 18-1, Red Drive, Red Bricks, all in A&J cases with Boston Camera engraved on them. Any information there, call Boston Camera on 617-277-2200. Again, all of this will be in the show notes. And Red 4452, a set of standards, Zeiss standards, Sony EX3, and lots more stuff from Filmstar Rentals, again in Boston. Contact Billy Mead there at Filmstar Rentals, 617-268-8811. Bastards, Christmas Eve.
Okay, but that isn't the end of it.
Yes, there's another one, Red number 804, along with all associated equipment, been stolen in New York City out of an unattended vehicle. Duh.
Yeah. Well, you don't know. I mean, maybe there was a camera car and somebody just put it down for a moment. But I give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, so details of if you spot Red 804 or if you know of any sort of nice cheap Red going in New York, someone's approached you in a pub.
So just to be clear about that, the numbers are 4452, 1746, and 804. Now, here's the thing. I think if you're listening to this show, you're one of us, and you're a good guy, right? But just on the off chance that you're thinking this is a good way to get a Red, the actual serial number of the chip is encoded into the R3D file. So if somebody was to find a clip with this in it, it's definitive proof that, you know when it was shot, you know what the serial number is.
Yeah.
A hard time kind of explaining how you just happened to have a couple of clips floating around from 804. So if somebody was to file off the serial numbers or do anything like that, it's not going to get you that far in the big scheme of things.
So every clip from camera, say 804, is in the metadata is going to have, this is shot on camera 804.
Yeah, yeah.
Genius.
And that's not something you can edit out. So, if you've got an R3D. So, I mean, could just be that they were after the lenses, of course, but it's unlikely.
Yeah, well, I guess like most criminals are pretty stupid, and I'm sure they'll find out that they're going to have something pretty worthless. So, yes, if anyone's sort of scouring eBay and find these things on for sale, then, yeah.
Just for the record, the people that stole it are bastards.
Yeah, Christmas Eve. And they had all the appropriate, all correct and insurance forms, and they had all the right forms, and so, there was no red flags to the rental companies or to any of the production people. So, there you go.
So now can I do my pun about shifting gear and discussing gear?
Go. Oh, you already did it.
And now, the Red Setter Gear Guide.
So, Jason, let's discuss gear.
Okay. Well, this is something that a lot of people have really been looking for, a really small, simple, lightweight, onboard standards converter to go from high def, from SDI out of the red to standard def gear. Now, I know you're interested in one of those. I know a few people who are really looking for something like this. The main issue with a lot of them is they're quite bulky and they're not really designed to be used on the camera. Or they're not very, on-camera friendly. They're designed to sort of sit on a shelf in a machine room. Redbyte is an Australian company who have done a very small little standards converter called, or down converter called the Decimator. Now, the other fantastic thing about this is really cheap. It's about $395. Everything I've seen so far up to now has been about $1,500, $2,000 and up. This is very small, very simple. It's about 3 inches square. And about an inch high. It will auto.
I'm really impressed that it auto detects 26 different video formats.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think you want to be able to just. It's really only got about two or three little dip switches on it. You can crop from 16:9 down to 4:3. You can set it to do 16:9 or 4:3 aspect in NTSC or PAL. And it runs from 5 volts to 20 volts. And it's, $395. So
that's
3 inches
by 3 inches by 1 inch.
Yeah, it's pretty small.
3 inches is like, this is like, we're talking iPhone.
Or less. Smaller than an iPhone.
My iPhone? Hang on. So now I don't have a ruler, but I reckon it's about iPhone size.
Yeah, it's probably.
But obviously. Deeper in depth than an iPhone. But
yeah.
That's what we're talking about. And red anodized kind of looking thing looks good.
So that if you go to redbytedesign.com, you can download a PDF brochure of it and also find your reseller. Even though they're in Australia, they've got resellers in Europe and the States. So it's $395 US, which is a mere $850,000.
And we haven't tested this yet, so we can't vouch for the video quality. But normally with a thing like this, it's actually just getting a signal because you're not going to use the final output. It's normally for a video split.
Yeah, that's the thing.
The colorimetry doesn't go wild.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's so keen to have these things because obviously a lot of people are coming from the film world where they've got thousands and thousands of dollars worth of gear invested in on-set monitors, Steadicams, you know, even your little sort of clamshell playback systems are mostly all standard def. So there's a lot of people with thousands involved in, you know, Steadicam rental and can't plug a Red into it. So everyone's busting to be able to get standard def out of these things and do it easily.
Now, I'm happy this week because we got our 18 to 85 back from Red. We had ours recalibrated and has significantly improved it because we wanted to get the back focus right, because it wasn't a back focus we could adjust out with the... With the
mount.
Yeah.
But, which you don't want to do anyway.
But the next item in your news list actually relates to that lovely 18 by 85 lens that I...
Well, this is something that I mentioned last time, probably Duclos lenses, a good friend of mine and also a fellow Twitterer.
What's his Twitter thing?
I think it's called Matt Duclos. I'll have to check that for you.
Is it?
But it's... they are making, I mentioned last time, they're making an 18-85 Delrin cap for the lens, because you really just want to just take the stock lens cap and just put it back in the box it came from and just leave it there. You don't want to sort of start using it or renting your camera out with it on. But they've just got a little special on for $75 for the rest of January. They've got a... they'll sell their machined out of solid piece of a Delrin lens cap. It's fascinating lens caps, Mike.
It's not fascinating, but it is actually quite useful because we were desperately trying to find a better lens cap so as to not risk having a mark on the front of our lens, which would appear as a sort of a less sharp, defocused-y kind of spot from the palm of your hand bending the one that ships with it and causing the rubbing of the glass. So, I mean, if you've got one, this is actually quite interesting news. And it's not even a money thing, even though it's great that the price went down. It's literally that you know, you couldn't buy one before.
Yeah, so that's duclosslenses.com. And I know it says 95 or something on the site, but 75 for January. So, yeah, if you've got one of those, if you're lucky enough to have one of those lenses, yeah, do it.
Order now.
Yes.
It's funny, you know, because... the whole thing about lenses and I mean, there's been a bit of a discussion about this, but you know, like there's this sense of the camera having metadata, but there's just a few things that you sort of so have to get right when you're doing stuff. And I've was in the habit of saying anything you can adjust on the lens is what you should adjust, because anything after that you can sort of adjust in post. Of course, the big exception to that that I screw up on when I say that is I mislead people into thinking they can adjust the shutter or the angle.
Yes.
So now I have to be slightly more accurate when I'm explaining that to people. Do you ever get that problem with people not understanding?
Well, yeah, look, the whole shutter thing, because this came up the other day with because I've sort of been talking in depth. There's a lot of talk about the D5. The Canon 5D Mark II, not having an adjustable shutter, or not having, I mean, it will adjust itself. Essentially, it'll adjust it by itself. You can't sort of manual control it. So even though it's fantastically capable of doing some really quite filmic images, it's as long as nothing actually moves. Because the one big giveaway from the footage and the Vincent Lafaurette's footage and all of that sort of stuff that's been shot so far on the 5D is been motion blur. It's really been the one big tell from that says, you know, film to me. Just screams it straight out of there. You can just go, bap, you know, video. So it, yeah, so I thought we would sort of cover shutters a bit today, because it certainly has come up, because there's a lot of people who have come from a video or a digital background that are trying to replicate that film look, have never really had that practical experience with a film camera and don't really know what are the mechanical basics, or what are the basics behind that that sort of govern those rules that make it that the little subtle things, the difference between that film look and not. So,
you know, I had that the other day, because I actually said to somebody about, you know, you could go 90 degrees, and he's like, why do you film guys always talk about shutters in terms of degrees? is it something? And I was like, because there are wheels. And he's like, what? What wheels? And I'm like, the shutter wheel. And he's like, I've got no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I was sort of just dawned on me in that moment that unless you are used to the mechanism of a film camera, it wouldn't make any sense to discuss this problem, which is how long the shutter is working in terms of degrees. It would just be like a completely arbitrary number, like why 180, why not 270, why not 360?
Exactly. Well, look. So if you imagine the shutter of a film camera as a revolving semicircle in front of the film, okay? So half the time it's out of the way of the lens to let light through, and the other, as it rotates, the other half of the time it's then blocking light so that the camera can move the film onto the next frame. Very simple. If you imagine the semicircular disc going round and round, when it's blocking, it's moving the film. When it's open, it's exposing. Now, physically, the camera just can't have any more than 180 degrees. It needs that time closed to be able to move the film. So, therefore, a film camera never has any more than 180 degrees, and it just can't create. So, therefore, if you say if you're running at 24 frames a second, right, you will have an exposure time of a 48th of a second. I made these fantastic notes, and I've gone totally and just jumped straight ahead into...
I've got to make notes. Half the time,
yes.
Half a circle, 180 equals half, so 24 frames a second, you want 1/48th effectively on a 180 degree shutter.
Exactly. So if you're shooting 24p, half of
now,
that...
Now, while it can't do it, obviously, in 360 degrees, because 360 degrees would mean that it's an electronic shutter, it's always open... Next frame happens, it's always open. Next frame, and you can't do that with film because you've got time to pull it in the gate.
Exactly.
In fact, you can go the other way, though. You can have less than 180 degrees, and you only open it for a fraction of less than half the time.
Exactly, and obviously that's what you want to sort of... That's where you get into the Private Ryan sort of territory, where you're sort of freezing motion, or if you know you want to have...
The Normandy Beach landing kind of...
Exactly, all the staccato sort of debris stuff. That's all shot at like 45 degrees and 90, mostly 45 degrees.
Shot stuff at 9, I think it was. That was the best I've ever got to on a film camera.
You're losing a lot of light when you get to get down to 9 degrees. Like, yeah, it's a stop every time you halve it.
Yeah, so it was a stop down to 45. For 90 was a stop. So 45 was a second stop.
So what I wanted to do is just explain. I'll just backtrack through the sort of theory so that we can understand what you need to do to stick with that film look. Okay, so basically then, if the standard out-of-box sort of setting essentially for a film camera will be 24 frames a second at 180 degree shutter. Now, that combination will give you 1/48th of a second, okay? Now, that is essentially what gives you that perfect natural film-looking motion blur. When you go with a longer shutter speed than that, then it starts to look more like video. And that's what the 5D is doing when it starts to look like video-ish, or any film camera where if you start to go outside that rule, then you start to get into video territory. So the golden rule then would be is to don't go any more than half your frame rate. Okay, so if you're doing 24p, you want to stick to a 48th of a second or a 50th of a second. 25p, a 50th, 30p, a 60th. So that will mean that you will be essentially replicating the film look and not giving yourself any more motion blur than is than film would.
Yeah, and this would apply equally if I was doing, say, 3D animation. I'd want motion blur that would only blur for half the interval. So if a digital object was moving across the screen and it's, you know, it would theoretically make it across the entire screen in one frame.
And I see that
for half the frame.
Yeah, I see it a lot in CGI. That's a big giveaway too of almost too much motion blur.
Yep.
All of a sudden, if you've got a background that's shot on film and that's moving at a certain motion blur and your foreground animated CGI Spider-Man or whatever, if he starts to have more motion blur in the background, then that's a total giveaway. I see that quite a lot.
And a concept is one thing. What this looks like on the screen, the word you'll hear people describe when they look at it is it looks like it's a bit smeary. It looks like the motion kind of smears. And if you've seen this thing, smear is a good word to describe it. It isn't actually smearing at all, but it feels like that's what's happening because we've all grown up. And of course, the other thing is this is artificial. Like we grew up where the quality productions, the quality films, were shot on film with a 180-degree shutter. So that's what we associate with high-quality look. There's nothing wrong with shooting video, but it's going to look like a sporting event, not a feature film. And that's just because we're conditioned to doing that.
Or you'll essentially, obviously, where you start to see video more look like, really look like video, is when it's in lower light. At the film camera, we can't shoot, we can't open the shutter anymore, we can't go any faster than 48. But a video camera will let you do that, and the 5D will just do it automatically. So that motion blur really comes into play in the lower light, and that's on a film camera you just won't see it.
Okay, now lock that away, put that in your head. I'm now going to go off on a rat hole. There was some really amazing work done at ILM to try and get a camera that didn't have a shutter like that, because they were trying to shoot super high-speed film of phosphor burns for explosions of stars. And the phosphor burns were so fast, so bright, and so awesome that you had to pull the film at an astonishing rate. And they actually tried having this kind of rotating prism that would effectively allow them to aim the image at the film as it moved past through the gate. And I think it worked. I don't think that its registration was very good in terms of stability.
No, so. It was more, and it had a lot of military applications. Those faster cameras, like if I'm remembering it right, Photasonics will do like 500 and up frames per second in film, and much more. But yeah, the registration is terrible because the film is not being stopped. It's just pulled through fast, and the prism kind of, as the film moves, the prism kind of aims the image at it, so it's not the best.
The Lucille Ball chocolate episode comes to mind.
You're right. The ever increasing
conveyor belt.
Yeah, exactly. So that they're almost aiming the image at the film as it goes past at speed, because theoretically at that speeds, the G forces are too much for the film. You literally can't stop and start the film that quick, because it's just even though it's quite miniature, the G-forces just would tear film apart. It happens all the time, even at 200 or 300 frames a second in film.
Who hasn't re-sprocketed a film at high speed? I mean, I know I have.
Who at one time or another hasn't
on an old Mitchell
hasn't opened the door frames of a camera and seen 90 feet of film concertinaed inside
and a huge amount of confetti all of dark film color.
Spend an hour pulling out little tiny little pieces of sprocket holes.
Just an hour.
Yes.
My favorite thing on set with high speed photography is that whole, like, I've done it, I've been on set, and the camera operator goes, "You ready? You sure you're ready?" The director's like, "Yeah, of course I'm fucking ready." And he goes, "Okay, and speed," and the director goes, the mag's out.
Oh, it's horrifying.
Speed, action, cut.
Yeah, no, we used to use the Panavision R300, which would go to 300 frames. And you literally have to, you put 1,000-foot loads on, just because the film wouldn't last very very long at a 400-footer. It would just literally, it would take about 10 seconds to get up to speed.
Bills in the
That's
back
right.
Of the room.
And there's no speed light on the thing. So as the camera assistant, you had to wait until you heard it sort of reach kind of peak speed before you could call it. And then the person, dropping the Coke bottle or whatever had to hear you do that. And then their reflexes of their hand had to release it.
But if they got it wrong, it wasn't just that it was the wrong speed. It was the wrong exposure, because the exposure would ramp as the speed got up to speed. So it would be an almost uncorrectable thing in post, because the exposure would sort of change over the first second or two of the shot.
Yes, if they dropped it too early, it was still going quite, it hadn't slowed down enough and it was overexposed.
Yes, so.
And then when things went wrong, I'm so glad that they've got things like the Phantom and stuff like now.
High speeds, you tend to get a really short shutter anyway, because obviously at what we're talking about, like high speed, it's already a fraction. But in fact, that's where you go wrong on the red. If I was to shoot, and everybody I know has done this, first time you do a slow-mo shot, you set it to 1/48, I'm at 24 frames a second. Ooh, let's go up to high speed, 120, and action.
Yes.
And it goes 120 at 1/48. Well, I'll just go 1/120. And what you get is video smearing moving slow motiony stuff.
Now I thought, I haven't done a lot of overcranking on the red, but I thought it, there was like the relative mode.
Yeah, if that worked, that would be great.
Okay, so it doesn't actually.
On the last build, and we checked this, I think, on build 17, it didn't work.
Because obviously it is all relative in a way, in a film camera.
Oh, yeah.
If you are going at 50 frames a second, all of a sudden your shutter speed does become a hundredth of a second, but it's all relative. You're going to play that. You're going to slow that down anyway.
In my day, son, when we first started, there was no relative mode. It was just we had an on-off switch, and we had to trust Jim that 2:1 was the best aspect ratio. Tell that to the kids today, they won't believe it. But anyway, yes, there is a relative button now, and as of like the last build I tested, which was prior to Christmas, we couldn't get the darn thing to work.
Okay.
Because you want that also for ramping, because the same thing happens on the ramp, right?
Yes.
If the shutter is constant and the ramp is happening, then effectively the exposure is changing, and you get not only a motion blur problem, but
you get exposure
problem.
Change.
Yep.
So, right, yeah, because I haven't really dug too deep into the menus to work all that stuff out, but I would have thought that the relative mode, I would have thought, if I was just a punter, pulling it out of the box and plugging in and go, oh, I'll just pull
it. Camera operator. Stick it in relative, you
git. Stick it in relative mode. Yes. No. So that's a bad idea.
Yes.
So really, so then the rule of thumb is then, theoretically, you should put your... So what's the rule of thumb then?
For what? Well, you just double it. I mean, if you're going to shoot 120, do it at 1/250. Another thing
right.
is, I will point out this. You don't have to be exactly exact. Like, I mean, if you did something at 196th, where it was meant to be 1/250th, that you're not going to tell the difference on, right?
Can you not? Isn't there a way? Can't you have the red show the shutter as a shutter angle?
Yes, yes, you can. But
saying then that would be relative.
Yeah, but if you were like you got an angle of, I don't know, some weird combination, it's red 170 degrees on 180 at high speed, you're not going to pick that, right? There are some combinations you can't pull off. There's not infinite sort of granularity on the buttons.
Yes.
You just got to get it pretty bloody close. But I know everybody that does high speed gets it wrong the first time.
Because if you set your shutter, because that's exactly the analogy on a film camera. If you say I want to go 120 frames a second and I've got a 180 degree shutter, you know that the shutter has to follow the shutter speed. So yes. If you're on the red.
Film guys go, I've set it at the beginning of the day at 180.
Yep.
It shouldn't change.
Exactly.
And the video guy the red guy, the DIT. The person that listens to this podcast, the intelligent connoisseur of digital redness, mm-hmm. would say, no, not quite. I would check it on every setup of your different film speed.
Because that sort of... because this is definitely where the everything will fall over. And all of a sudden you go over cranking and you've got this horrible smearing.
Yeah, that's
thing.
Exactly what happens. Everybody I know that does it, the first time they do it, they go, oh, bugger.
So this really means that DIT dudes listening... You don't need to just know how to plug your RAID into your laptop and how to copy cards and when's a good time to pop on set and
what
DP likes.
You should know menu stuff. Well, is that a DIT or is that a camera department, camera operator problem?
Well, there's still that crossover period on set where your focus pullers, where your camera assistant knows some of the gear and there's a little bit of that sort of deep menu sort of stuff, exactly like that. You know, the shutter stuff, where you often go, dude, hello, red dude, help.
That would be me normally, because they look at me and they go, oh, well, he knows a lot about it. Mike, which button do you press to change it? Hey, here's the other thing I find, right? And I actually saw this, because like in Get Smart, they shot as the sun went down.
Yes.
They opened it up to 360.
Exactly.
And it looked video-y to me. Didn't look at, obviously, the DP who's won Academy Awards, who decided to do that. But
I think he probably regrets that.
You don't. No, he's a good DOP.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
seriously,
far more intelligent a chap than I am. But he did make that decision, which I found dubious. But my point is this: it isn't really obvious from the LCD.
Yes.
So if you're looking at it on the LCD up at the camera, you may not see this smearing effect as an audience would projected on a 60-foot bloody screen at the multiplex.
Yeah, that's true.
So
now, obviously, that decision was based on light.
But he was in a video tent when he made that decision.
Yeah.
Because he said in an interview in American Cinematographer, when he probably snowed out the door, it was practically black outside.
See, if he's in a video tent, he's probably the other end of a very nice monitor going out of whatever comes out of the back of a Genesis SDI.
I mean, was it the right decision? I mean, if they couldn't get to the shot and couldn't come back tomorrow And it's the difference between Mike Semmel whinging about it as a video effect or not having that shot in the film and thus having no continuity of where the actors were.
They'll take your whinge.
They'll take my whinge.
Because they'll never have heard it anyway.
Wouldn't care anyway. But my point is this. You guys who are listening to this need to be making those decisions based on something like that. Like, it's a fault we're buying because we deliberately intend to, not why does that look like shit on the screen? I'm not going to shoot with a red because this test looks like crap. When somebody could have just set the camera up properly and the DOP would have gone, oh, that looks really filmic and I really like that.
Yeah. So the rule with everything then is really is keep that 180-degree shutter rule, unless, of course, you're overcranking with the red, in which case...
Well, still make sure it's 180 degrees. Just make sure it's, you check it on each major camera setup.
Yeah. So theoretically, so then if you're going to go overcrank with a red and go to 50 frames a second, you need to put your shutter on...
100. If you are shooting at 50 frames a second, yeah, each frame is exposed for 1/50th of a second. Agreed? 50 frames a second, the best you could do at a 360 degree is 1/50th.
With a 360 degree shutter, yes.
Okay. 180 degrees means that instead of being exposed for 1/50th of a second,
yes,
I want to be 1/100th of a second. And if I set it like that, the camera would show 180 degree on the back camera menu.
Yes.
Okay. It wouldn't show 90 degrees because it's saying at this speed, at this shutter, you've got effectively 180 degree shutter.
Okay. Yep.
The way I'd explain it to people is take the readout as this is what you're doing, not this is a number that's driving the camera. It's like a passive number. It's telling you this is what you're currently kind of getting, not this is where I dial it in.
Yep. Okay. So, yeah, whatever factor you increase your frames per second beyond 25 or 24, then that's what you apply to your shutter speed.
And it works all the way up and down the line. 1/48 is 1/24th.
Yep.
Yep.
And simple. Don't trust the relative mode.
I wouldn't in this build. Mm. That would be my advice. Okay, okay, probably long enough spent on that. Let's go to your red room.
I'm speaking with multi-award winning DP, David Geddes, CSC, who, amongst other things like 21 Jump Street, MacGyver, 90210, Dark Angel, Night at the Museum, Halloween Resurrection. He also shot the Sci-Fi Channel series Sanctuary. Hey, David.
Hello.
Did I get any of that right?
You did. Even I forgot about the MacGyver.
Ah, you can't forget about MacGyver.
No, I didn't actually. I didn't shoot the series. I was fortunate enough. They made two movies of the week, which was great fun because it took me to London.
Oh, great!
So I got to hang out in London for 4 months. So ever thankful for that experience.
Fantastic. So you're based in Vancouver.
Vancouver and Los Angeles.
And congrats on pulling off Sanctuary, which is probably, well, we know it was a complicated shoot, but it was probably also, being a series, probably a really tough schedule.
Sanctuary was particularly a tough schedule. We had interest in that, of course, so much of it is financial. Time is money. We didn't have a lot of money, so that translated into not a lot of time. We did most shows on a 7-day schedule. We did a couple of days on a 6-day schedule, and we actually shot one episode in 5 days. So it was frantic, to say the least. It was because so much of it was virtual reality. Everything we did was on stage. We never left the stages. So with traditional episodic televisions, where they break it down, where they'll shoot for, you know, let's say 4 days on set and go on the road for 4 days, or shoot, you know, however they break it down, 5 days on set, 3 days on the road, so they can get some location work in. Our locations were green screen. So we didn't have trucks. We pulled up to the stages, unloaded all the equipment, and it stayed there for, I guess, 4 months that we shot. So it was interesting because we had to go everywhere in the world, but without actually having to go outside.
Exactly. And no magic hour, no sort of running out of light, no location moves, nothing.
Nothing. That's correct. So taking that into consideration, then it's made the production much more efficient.
Well, look, can I just step back a bit? And if you can just give us a little bit of your background and how you got here.
I worked my way through the, you know, within the industry and starting as an assistant and worked my way up, you know, and becoming an operator. I mean, I did a lot of documentary work, National Film Board of Canada, CBC, which was a lot of fun, you know, a lot of traveling, meeting a lot of interesting people. But then while doing that, then I would work on the few dramatic pictures that I could find work with. Ended up being an operator on 21 Jump Street. I operated the first two seasons, and I came in to work one evening for a night shoot, and the producers came running up and said, "Oh, our director of photography is sick. We've had to send him to the hospital. So we need you to take over." So I shot the next couple of days, and they offered me the show the next season. So I ended up shooting Jump Street the final two seasons, and then that was my big kickstart to my career.
Right, and you've pretty much been doing a lot of series ever since, I guess.
Right, a lot of series with a mix of movies of the week and features.
Am I right? I'm right in saying Sanctuary is the first TV series to be shot on Red.
It is the first TV series to be shot on Red. And interesting enough, I don't know if you know, they interviewed me for the November issue of American Cinematographer. And they researched that because, of course, movies are famous for being the first to do anything and everything, which is not usually true, as you know. It's always been done before. But they actually researched it. Yes, we were the first one to shoot a series with the Red.
How did Red come to be used for the show? Where did the motivation to use it come from?
Because of the virtual reality is so, you know, such a heavy visual effects show. The visual effects house was the first one that researched it and said, you know what, this sounds like a piece of equipment that would be perfect for our show. The reason being was that we were able to shoot digital and leave it digital, because for the visual effects, whatever else we shot in would have to be rendered to digital. Everything stayed on hard drives, so we actually never went to tape until actual delivery.
So how did you, obviously you've got a huge film background, what was the transition like going to Red?
It was a huge learning curve. And, you know, that was actually one of the most enjoyable parts. Of course, it was something to me, you know, completely brand new. Up until that point, I'd only done a little bit of HD even. At the same time, I noticed that it was like shooting in RAW with my, you know, digital photography. I've been, you know, doing a lot of work with the Canons, and it seemed to work in similar situations as the stills cameras did. But of course, the good thing about the Red is that they have the PL mounts, so I could use all of my traditional cinema lenses.
So did it make things fast when you're sort of quickly lighting green screens? Did you find yourself going quicker or slowing you down? Or
no, I mean, it's interesting enough, the camera itself didn't really play into any kind of scheduling problems or any kind of production problems. You know, we just tackled any kind of grip of lighting the same way as we would if it was an HD or a film kind of project. I mean, taking into consideration, of course, the different latitude that the Red has compared to, you know, to film or to HD. But it really just fell into place, and, you know, we just clicked along. I mean, it was terrific. I mean, it was just really never had any production problems, certainly with the camera.
Do you know much about the workflow post-shoot, what they did with the footage?
Here's another interesting story, too, because we were being the first one to do this. The bonding company had a big problem because, of course, they didn't know, there was no, nobody had a track record with it. So they said, okay, what is the original? So, you know, what is our negative? Where is it going to be kept? So we ended up doing multiple backups. We, you know, to hard drive, to LTO3 tape. So we had multiple hard drive backups. The one hard drive would go to editing. One hard drive would go to the visual effects house. So in actual fact, we had three backups. Editing would take their hard drive and dub it to just standard depth, and then load it to Final Cut. Visual effects, they just kept theirs in a 4K workflow for their post-house work.
What was the sort of workflow on set with I mean, were you using motion control or just markers everywhere or just run and gun? What was your...
Yeah. Well, depending on how much work we had to get that day. Well, most of the time it was run and gun, but it was run and gun with a lot of markers. We had to be fairly careful with our markers. We couldn't afford motion control, so there was never any motion control. But with the markers, you know, our wide shots were fairly easy to do because we had permanently affixed markers to the green screen. So that was, you know, really no difficulty. When we got into dealing with coverage, when we had a lot of, you know, a lot less depth of field, so the markers in the green screen would disappear. You know, they would just go to mush. So we would move in. We had mobile stands that were just there with markers stuck on them that we would introduce into those particular shots. So we were fairly careful having to have markers.
So you must have shooting green screen with the red down to a fine art by now. Is there any pointers for people? Green screen, blue screen, at exposure, under exposure? What do we rate the camera at?
So, let's see. Can I sell these answers?
I think you probably could. Definitely.
I mean, I treated the green screen that's the same as I have in the past. I mean, I had a lot of experience with green screen before I got to this show, you know, with, you know, Dark Angel, The Messengers, that type of thing. So really what it came down to was testing the camera to see how it reacted best to green screen. I felt we usually got our best results if I was in a full green screen room. In our virtual reality stage, I would rate it at 250. It just seemed to give us the cleanest image. I mean, it's almost the same as if you think in terms of shooting film. You always get the better quality image out of a green screen if you're shooting lower ASA stocks, you know, like a 200 ASA stock. It worked that same way. When I had a combination, if I had a green screen on a traditional set, I usually ended up just rating it at 350. I say it seemed to work best at that.
Right. And running the green screens just at exposure?
Pretty much we just ran the green screen at exposure. Because you're already in the full digital format, doing the green color keys, it came off clean. I mean, we discovered that we could have like two stops variance over the green, and it really didn't matter just because of being already in that digital format. It was just really easy to pull keys.
What about color temp?
Well, that's a good point. I'd actually like to get into their R&D and see if it's possible to make a tungsten sensor, because they certainly, the red sensor seem to love daylight. Certainly much, I guess, a much more saturated image. I don't know quite how to explain it. There just seemed to be a lot more detail shooting daylight with that sensor. That was one of the reasons why I backed the ASA off when I would go into a full tungsten situation. But at the same time, it really didn't give us any complications. You would think, it being a daylight balance, that it should really only, you know, it would work best in daylight. It just, you know, financially, you couldn't turn a green screen into situation into gelling lights or shooting with HMIs. You could never afford to do it. So, you know, we just set the camera to tungsten, and it seemed to, as like I said, if you gave it a little more ASA, it worked fine under a tungsten situation.
All your backgrounds being replaced later, was there much benefit to having low depth of field of you know, the 35mm sensor? You probably could have shot it on something that was a smaller sensor and made life sort of easier for yourself focus-wise, I guess. I mean, did you notice the fact that you were working with 35mm depth, and was it a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, where do you start with that question? I mean, certainly for the first camera assistants, I think they would probably love to have more depth of field. you know, that was the one thing we found with the red sensor, that it actually had the feeling of less depth of field than film, because it was, the sensor itself is so sharp that the focus drop off is very fast and very quick. So we realized we had to have very, very good focus pullers. But because of that, it certainly gave you the feel that you were shooting on film. You know, it was nice to be able to have that limited depth of field, to be able to put the focus to where you wanted the people to look.
So you mentioned using just regular film lenses. Can you run through what sort of gear you were using to go with the camera?
I had a nice match set of Cook S4s, and then I had a couple of zooms. I used the Optimo zooms. So it was fairly traditional, what you would want to call episodic television lensing. You know, very efficient, very first assistant friendly, very production friendly. So in that way, I mean, working with the Red, really all it was, we just had a different capture device attached to the lenses that... any other production would be using.
If Red comes on the next show, are you going to run the opposite direction or?
No, I mean, it was quite exciting. I mean, it's great to get your hands on new stuff, new toys, sit down and figure it out. And it's always fun finding a new image capture technology and see what you can do with it and where you can take it and, how you can, advance, filmmaking.
So, Dave, how can people find you?
Well, I guess the easiest thing is just my website, davidgeddes.com, because under the contact is my list of agents and phone numbers or, my email.
Look, thank you, David. Thanks for your time. It's been fantastic talking to you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
See ya.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that, Jace. Virtual set stuff just come so far, and the Red does have, like on green screen, really good responses when shot right.
Yeah, look, I mean, as I say, I was asking him all the stuff about color temp and, what do you rate it at? And he said, look, we were in a rush. I didn't have time to do a lot of color temp. I didn't have the control or the budget. We just shot it and shot it and shot it. And it doesn't matter what we threw at it. And he got great king. So impressive.
Well, now we're going to shift to post-production, and we're going to continue with our series on looking at various options for doing post-production. And what we wanted to follow up on was digital vision. We mentioned it before, but we actually got to sit down with Warren Lynch. Now, Warren actually graded on Lord of the Rings back in the day over at in New Zealand, and he's since set up shop in Australia. And Jason and I were lucky enough to go down and talk with him at his new facility. He's done several Red features, including The Nothing Men, which was in the very early days of Red. Really, October, kind of about a month or two after the cameras came out. But before I get to that, I just want to give an update on digital vision, because obviously Warren doesn't work for digital vision. And it is important to understand where they are, because prior to Christmas, they were in effectively a Chapter 11, or their version of Chapter 11 from Stockholm. And Digital Vision announced, I think around the 18th of December, Jason, that they'd come up with a solution, they believe, to their financial problems, which was to have a stock issue. And I'm just going to quote, because I can't comment on whether or not this is going to solve their problems, but I can quote you what the CEO Gert, okay, I'm going to say this, Schulbergen said. He's the acting CEO of Digital Vision. Yeah, thanks, man. And it's with great pleasure that I can report the funding for the continued operation of Digital Vision has been secured. So from their point of view, they're going to issue a whole bunch of stock, and this will refinance and solve a lot of their debt equity problems that's hung over the company. I don't know if that's the case, but apparently it is. This is just based on the stuff that happened around Christmas 2008. But it was good going down, and Warren's a great guy.
Yeah, he's very cruisy, very, very, very strained,
very
relaxed,
yeah.
Attitude to everything.
Quite
but
modest.
I think he's got the only. Is it the Film Master panel? What's he?
Yeah, he's got the full Film Master, and it has the R3D option, which is like the latest version of the software that came along that allows him to actually fully read R3D files. He can conform from the R3Ds, he can work on the R3Ds directly, and he has pull-down menu options to do the sort of things that you'd expect, like choose color space and look at metadata. It's a proper implementation. In fact, it's kind of like everything we hope that will come from the SDKs. Digital Vision managed to do it earlier than most because their underlying platform is based off NT and not off Linux. and the Linux SDK hasn't been released yet. That's what we're seeing delays on. So companies that require a Linux platform, that would be like an Autodesk or a DaVinci or somebody, haven't been able to hit this level of implementation. Digital Vision have.
It's interesting that this, I mean, I think he's got the only desk here in Australia, right? I think there's very few. I think there's very few of them around, which surprises me, because because Warren's sort of essentially a freelance guy, this is his, you know, his choice. It's not any company choice thrust upon him. He's not gone to work for a company that already has a system embedded. He had the choice of essentially every any grading panel in the world, and it's a real interesting, a real great sort of nod to Digital Vision that Warren, who's an absolute god of color, I think, who's actually, his choice was to go with this desk. So interesting that they're not that widespread, and I mean, you know, great to see a few more of them around, particularly if they're going to have the red implementation.
Yeah, you know, I'm a huge Joy Division fan. You know, they did that biopic on Ian Curtis. Joy Division, as in the precursor to New Order.
Yep.
Yeah, so that was all done at, I think, Chimney Pot in Sweden on the New Coda. And I remember hearing good things about it then. And I think I'm right in saying that Happy Feet may have even been through the New Coda when it was at Animal.
Right.
So there's, you know, definitely projects.
Right.
I think Post Group in LA has one as well. There's quite a few places around, certainly BBC and stuff. But let's cross over now to Warren and have a listen to his impression of working with the both the desk actually and the R3D implementation.
Warren, thanks so much for joining us on Red Center. We really appreciate it. Now, you've actually graded a heck of a lot of Red footage in terms of independent films and other things, haven't you? How long have you been sort of doing stuff?
I think just about as soon as your camera arrived in town, and we came to visit and saw what that was about for a feature of The Nothing Men. And from that, it was, I guess, 8-9 months ago, was it? I don't know, but quite a long time. So from then, we did the whole feature with that rig, and I've since finished another movie called Cedar Boys, and prepping at the moment for which will be our fourth movie, I think, for early next year. And and amongst that, other various jobs for, you know, from music video clips through to television commercials and you know, documentary and all sorts of various things.
Now, I'm really keen to talk to you at two levels. One, because you have this country's leading new coda user, so you really understand how to use that, and that has R3D support now.
Yes.
But prior to that, even you were grading off DPXs that have been transferred in other ways, because you know you have that earlier experience before the SDK came out.
Yes.
So I'm interested in your opinions, if we could start just on the Red and some of the workflow issues, and then if we could move to how the desk is performing for you, that would be really of great interest. And I guess one of the things is just your take on, you know, if I was a DOP coming to talk to you about shooting on the Red, what's your advice to me as a DOP? And because that's pretty relevant, because you really see a lot of the results.
From the early days when we first met your camera and the build of that version, I think it was build 8 or something, I'm not sure the numbers, but the camera was limited and it had, you know, limitations imposed upon it to make it perform, and it was really very good. And, you know, the picture quality was, you know, noise-free and all the good things, and we did the Nothing Men feature with that, and it was a breeze in a lot of ways because the picture was so well off in lots of areas that it made my work quite easy. But as you say, in the early days, we didn't have the plugins to make it work on the Filmmaster, so I went back to basics and transcoded from the R3D files over to DPX. And in that case, we went for 2K and turned it to 2K log and transcoded manually, which was kind of crazy, but it took 3 weeks, and we had someone employed for the period of time to just go through the EDL and sort the list and pick up shots and transcode into the DPX format, carrying the code. And so really, that was the only hard part. And that was put in the budget and put in the timeline to accommodate that. And as soon as the shots arrived online to the machine, the EDL plugged in and conformed instantly. So it was easy work in that way. And the next movie we did a little bit better because we used a combination of XML import from the editing department and then pulled print takes to transcode. So it wasn't so manual, but still took the time to do the transcoding. And that took, I think, a week to do the next movie by hand, relatively. But and various other things, even, as I said, the music videos and the you know, commercials and whatever were probably done by hand and variations of the above. But now, since the plugins are here, it's pretty simple. Simply the machine looks straight at the
R3D. Not only can it read the R3Ds, but it can conform from the R3Ds, can't it?
Yeah, all I need is the shots on the discs and the machine will find them. And the only, you know, tricky stuff is to make sure that the editing department haven't renamed the shot names and things. And,
yeah.
And in particular, the first film was cut with Final Cut Pro. We transcoded to ProRes rushes just to make it simple for the Final Cut Pro suite, not needing to be fully decked with lots of space and power. So it was a fairly, you know, average Final Cut Pro suite and was running nice, lightweight, you know, proxies of the original shots and carrying the time code, and that all worked quite well and there was no dramas. And then the next film was cut on Avid, just a standard def Avid, and in that case I just did dailies every day to Avid standard def PAL rushes, and then used Metacheeta to link the code, and that film was cut no trouble, and same again. EDL came back, and all the request was just to print out basically the shot names in the EDL and retain all that. So, and the next movie we're doing is cut on Avid, and same again. Providing the shot names stay the same, it's easy.
And, asking about before, I'd love your opinion, for example, on advice to a DOP, because obviously you've seen and done a lot of tests, been involved with tests, and you've also, of course, seen all the stuff back from, say, Weta or wherever you're getting the film outs.
That's right, yeah.
What's your sort of advice on how you think the camera, what's its sort of sweet spot?
Yeah. I guess I led to that earlier, that Build 8 was limited in its sort of offerings to the DP, but when the cameras became more and more accessible for ASA and frames per second and, you know, various things, I believe, and I don't know if it's true, but the picture quality was suffering a little bit. I think around build 15 and build 16, there was issues in the shadows and certain colour temperatures. But of all that information, and then since speaking to, you know, Ted a number of times and particularly asking about what the camera was made to do and what, you know, what its sweet spot was, he since informed us that, you know, 5,100, 5,000 degrees is the best place for the imager to be. From that, and experiencing the various pitches that had been pushed through to places where the camera wasn't performing so nicely, I kind of came back to this sweet spot, which I believe is, if you can get the camera into a 5,000 degrees place and keep the ASA somewhere around 250 to 320, you know. Really the relativity, I suppose, is that just imagine it's 250D film stock and then get in with some lights. But again, it's early days and perhaps the next build might have a new way of approaching that low end. I know the camera didn't like tungsten too much. It gets a bit upset in low light tungsten. And particularly, for instance, in a room, if you went into a tungsten-lit room without any good contrast ratio, no practicals or just straight beige walls, you're asking for serious trouble because it's just going to not know what to do with that.
Yeah.
So it's really back to the rules of photography that any good shot does have a white point reference and some black reference and paint in the colour that you need to tell your story. But it seems like it's a bit similar to any good photograph that if it's got some of those references in there, it will work nicely. But
I think your 250D thing is absolutely on the money. It's you know, it's probably the best way to present it also, because it is responding more like a film camera than a upscale DV camera.
Yeah.
Like it is, it needs a good grade.
Yeah.
It needs care in the transfer. It's not like...
And it needs a base level of light, of course. But, you know, but I think a lot of people assume it's just like any other, you know, really expensive video camera, HD cam, F900, you know, variations on such, and that it's quite, you know, easy to get all these things. But again, you know, I think treating it more like a film camera is a good thing, because it's it limits you in lots of ways and makes you be more careful about the way things are lit. The good example just recently is that before the DP went off to shoot with these cameras, he'd never used them before, and only experience he'd had was with HD cam and F900s and Genesis. And he initially was quite sort of not impressed with the Red camera, because it didn't give him all those $250,000 camera things. But, and you know, but once we got together and talked about the base level of light and temperatures to watch out for, and you know, things that do make the camera come alive, he slowly and steadily came around to it and actually started to work with it, and got straight on the phone to the producer and said, let's get the big gaffer truck, you know, for these reasons. And and the picture is the best I've seen yet. And
oh, good.
In the same sort of build area of what some films had been shot a little bit sort of rough and ready, and had shown some of the problems with the bottom end.
I guess the $64,000 question is, as a senior colourist with tons of experience with film and DaVinci and all the stuff over the years, if you're sitting down to grade some stuff that is shot like this, the 250D kind of model, are you noticing the compression artifacts? Are you noticing the lack of flexibility? I'm not talking the latitude in the camera now, but like actually when you start grading it, it breaks apart? Because, I mean, I trust your eyes.
No, it'll stay totally intact. In fact, really robust. If it's a good, you know, good image to start, the system will take to it and, you know, do anything really without any trouble. So it's not...
So it's not brittle and easy to sort of like hit the walls and get into trouble.
Providing it's been well delivered. And now that all of the sort of front end has been removed from transcoding, which even if done, you know, if done badly can present problems. But
sure.
Most of the project I've been doing have been done nicely and within spec. But you know, providing it all meets the machine nicely, well intact, it'll do anything.
In terms of taking it out to film... couple of things. Firstly, do you like the look when it's on film? And secondly, do the people that you work with feel that they're missing things like film grain and want that added? Or is it its own look and people are comfortable with that?
Well, a number of tests I've done and film out that I've done a whole feature. The picture is as good as film, according to the director and the DP. They just say to each other, wow, doesn't this look like what we did if we'd have shot film? So to my way of thinking, and the way I work is I look at the film lookup table. So the really, you know, the picture at the result end is very filmic and, you know, very impressive. A lot to do with lenses and you know, style. But generally, no, it's very much like film, and I can present an anamorphic print to the people after we've done our tests, which they all study and look at, and we... you know, tune it to the nth degree and then put it out to film, and back it comes, perfection. So it's really just like doing a film scanned, film originated job from, you know, right the way through. So, you know, the results are wonderful. In fact, always impressed with how good it looks on the cinema screen.
Yeah, well, I mean, I creatively love your grading, I always have. I remember once we did a thing for Korea and you just amazed me with the colour palette stuff that you're doing. So let's talk about some of the creative stuff now, because you're on this desk and have been for a while. And we've touched on it already. You can now read R3Ds natively.
Yeah.
So what is the workflow if I came to you now for a project?
Yeah.
Let's say we're talking about a film. It's going to end on film.
Yeah.
What would be your workflow?
Well, basically, editorial aside, I need the original camera shots stored in the machine. and then an EDL from editorial. And so conform is standard, so that'll just be easy.
Do you get to pick which time code you get off the R3D files? Are you going off time of day?
Time of day, yeah. I tend to be at the pre-production meeting and ask for the time of day. At the moment, the choices for choosing the time codes is, I think, limited, so I need to have time of day code. But and it prefers to be in that mode.
Right.
And all of the movies we've done have been that way. So, but if...
And do you get access to the metadata stuff, such as, like, if I wanted to change the ISO that I'd shot at?
Yeah.
How's it coming into the system, or is it coming in as linear and you're just putting stuff on top of it?
No, it's totally, totally okay. So I've got four shots here of something that you guys brought with you, but it's basically a matter of just pulling the clip that we want to work with, and then in the input, in the library, basically, it comes with a properties table, a properties panel, and within here is all of the things. So the colour space, the gamma curve applied, the ASA.
So we've got red space. Can you just hit on the colour spaces? So we've got...
Yeah, so in here we've got...
Rec 709, linear, red log, red log, the whole lot.
Yep, and so in a linear job I'd leave this upper section here alone, but in a log job I choose from whichever format I'm going to present them to the machine how I need. So, you know,
so you present logarithmic files to the machine so that you're grading logarithmically and log what comes out.
Yeah.
And whose log curve are you using for that? Because, like, for example, Autodesk recently has said the closest thing to a Cineon file is to go red log, reds 983. Log format, and then drop it to exposure points.
Yes.
Because there is no sort of immediately... No. Like, how do you solve the log to recorder problem?
Yeah, what I used to do was use PD685 through Red Cine to get it more toward standard Cineon, and that was good. But this, again, doesn't have that. So my approach for this will be I'll put Red Log in and Film Log to present to the machine, so it knows what it is. And then I'll do a pull down, probably 2-3 points down to get it back into 685 zone.
Right.
And possibly some contrast. But I'll put that as a standard base setting for all shots once I've done the measurements. But simply that will get me back in the log ballpark. And then I just use a CineSpace lookup table to present to me in on monitor.
Because you're going to want to be presenting in a 3D LUT that's monitoring the presumably print film out.
Yeah, that's right. So all the access to the stuff here, the time code, the shot name, it's Kelvin, how much decode quality, you know, full through to draft things.
You've done ASA. 4K and 2K tests through the desk.
Yeah.
Is there a big difference, much of a difference at all?
Not really. All the time, these have to be cached, so it can play through 4K shots, ungraded and things, but as soon as you apply any of the transitional things to make it present to the machine, it'll need to render those. So even though it'll get along off 4K at about, you know, frame per second or something. But so generally, if without anything done to it, it'll play the 4K nicely. But due to the fact I've got to get it into my environment, I will always, at the conform stage, pull all the shots in, check them, and then render cache files so that I'll see what I'm getting. And
those cache files are presumably smaller resolution for...
They can be 4K, or they can, but I'm working most of the time at 2K, because...
Do most films need 4K, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say. I don't think so. For a film out, it's not... The tests that we've done of 4K full-spec grade through to film recorder, ARRI laser, 4K film record, and then the same job 2K, and putting them back to back. You can sit in the cinema with the biggest screen and, you know, this anamorphic presentation, and it's really difficult to tell. There is, you know, things that I see, like fine detail in hair that are a little bit cleaner on 4K, and skin pore detail a little bit cleaner. But for the, you know, the event of time it takes and sort of cost, it's hard to justify. So, because the 2K is just pretty anyway.
Yeah, I mean, 2K has been what we've been used to for so many years.
But, you know, I guess you know, if it came to finishing at 4K, that, you know, it's no drama, but just means the more disk space and more time. And
you're just choosing it because in the equation of time, money, budget, resources and everything else, it's right. not giving you a huge plus.
Yes,
and then, and so you're grading in a log space now with all of the tools that you've got on the desk.
Yeah.
Decoding, so there's a decode to the cache files.
Yeah.
You can access the R3Ds raw.
Yes.
But it's the cache files that are in the intermediate. Are they in an intermediate DPX format or some other format?
They're DPX. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. RGB DPX. So often when I'm grading, I, because of performance reasons, I run in HD. So I can run another output port from here to the HD port on the barcode.
Oh, so with sort a of multiple table. Splits out from the from the machine. Oh, that's nice.
So the good thing about this machine is that all of those outputs are available. You just dial in whatever you pretend, you know, you need to do by the end of the job and have them all choosing in a pick box. So to run a HD output, even though I'm running a 4K grade and, you know, on my screen here, it's all set up ready.
And presumably this is clip-based colouring, so if we get a, which you obviously would, revisions to the EDLs as they tweak Reel 3, then you're not going to have to do a whole backtrace to solve that because it's all clip-based.
It's linked to each shot, all of the settings link, and the new EDL is just another import and conform.
And then would you normally version those features? Because that's the feature film looking at the LUT for the projection stream. I mean, obviously HD and standard def are big markets for films. You do a second or third pass for those?
No. The way the system works is that it's all calibrated so that all of those outputs, PAL, NTSC, high def, Cineon, whatever log space I'm looking at, all mean that I can switch between all of the formats and the picture stays the same.
So
and therefore, grade at once, play it out or render out to as many formats as needed without having to.
How do you find the panel? Because, you know, it's great for any colourist to be able to work with both hands and really focus on the images.
Well, it's just like any other standard piano. It's kind of back to the tools in front of you, you know, with, you know, your standard issue controls, just like an DaVinci or a Pogel, I suppose, or, you know. So it's really relative, and it's just like sitting down behind the piano and all the things in the right places. And the you know, you'll see the later generation machines like this that don't actually have any labels on them, because the early model machines had a position on the outside of the rings of where red, green and blue were in the old joystick days, so that you knew that you wanted to head toward warm, that you'd have to head it towards the red side. So, but that's all sort of become piano playing now, so you don't even look at the desk. It's just the extension of your brain, and out it comes. So it's pretty, you know, as say, and all the button layout's been well thought of. There's some things that, you know, as every desk comes with, it's a little bit different. But as far as I'm concerned, it's probably the best thing that I've met for what I do in many years.
And what is the company's website if someone wants to find out more about IC?
It's icfilms.com.au.
Warren, I can't thank you enough for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Cheers.
Well, thank Warren for that. And it was fun sitting down there and hanging out. That's about it for this week. We've gone over, I'm afraid. Big rave on Shudders hasn't helped.
Argument. Battle.
Personally, from a personal point of view, I actually kind of like those chats almost more than doing the more formal news and stuff, though I understand the benefit of those other things. So I apologise, certainly, if I contributed to wasting your time this weekend going over.
Never.
Okay, so we are going to be having a really good year, I think. We may be coming out up to once every fortnight, not necessarily every week. It really depends. We had anticipated going weekly as we built up to NAB, with NAB not happening. But keep checking back. You can obviously get to links off fxguide.com. Jace, you're on Twitter at?
Wingrove. At Twitter?
At Wingrove.
/Wingrove.
That's it.
A nice short name.
It's like Cher, or, you know, sort of one of those single name things, isn't it?
Cher.
You don't need, like, you know, you're Bono, I should have said.
That's right, yeah, exactly.
Sorry. I said Cher, you're thinking Bono, yeah. And I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter. Until next time, I'll see you guys later.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.